Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minutes past the hour, and we begin this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, and that's where you'll find the Listen Live button for those of you listening on Windows Media Player. There are other links for those of you who are not. You'll also find there the entrance to the chat room, which is free and easy, and which is getting its usual denizens together. Even as we speak, good evening, Sparky, good evening, Jan, good evening, Sergi, and more will come in as time passes. If you're not listening on a PC or some sort of more traditional computer, maybe you're listening on a tablet or some sort of smart device, iPhone, Android device, what have you, you can always use the apps at from either Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You might get an ad there once in a while. Please understand, those are not placed by the Horn. Nor do we receive any recompense for them. Capitalism, yay! They work quite well. Also, of course, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the PayPal button and the traditional mail address. The traditional mail address being the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, Hall Mary Baker. PMB 318 Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801, with the gentle reminder that checks and money orders should be made to Head On Communications, the Horn, something like that, and not to Bob Kincaid, as I do not see them. And Bob and Boss Man Wayne sends them off for bill paying purposes. So there's that. And toward that end, I want to thank Sparky, and I want to thank our buddy Tom, and I want to thank Jan and Mark and Paul, all of whom made it possible for us to enter this Tuesday of the broadcast week, which is the first day of the broadcast week because Agnes and I had to be away from the studio yesterday. But we enter even for fundraising for the week. So hallelujah. That means this evening we look to raise $10 a piece from 15 people, $15 a piece from 10 people, 2 from 75, 3 from 50 from 3, 3 from 50. You know how that goes. But $150 is what we seek to raise on any given broadcast evening, and that is the goal, so that there can be a Horn next month. Let's see. I was gone for more in Monday, and again, my apologies. Probably the biggest thing that broke yesterday was that Judge Richard Leon in Washington, D.C., discovered that the National Security Administration is chock full of morons. And not the humorous kind, but the kind who are prone to slickety and slippery and sleazy deals in the middle of the night. And dropped an opinion on them that appears to be a significant blow to the domestic spying program that is extant in this country. And to him I say thank you, and I'm sure many of us do. I also say don't run to the bank with this, because it's going to go up to the D.C. circuit, and it'll be and eventually it will wind and wend and fend its way through to the Supreme Court of the United States, also known as the RATS, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, Plus Kennedy, that man of iron will and unchallengeable courage, Anthony Kennedy. Who knows what'll happen? You would think right wingers would be upset about the liquidation of the Fourth Amendment, but I wouldn't hold my breath if I were you. But still, it's nice to see that somebody, somewhere, especially a judge, has some sort of working understanding that privacy does matter even in the 21st century and the second decade thereof. Toward that end, I received over the weekend, last night as a matter of fact, one of those pieces of correspondence from our buddy Harry, now of Balmer, formerly of Washington, D.C., with some background on Judge Leon and some observations on the judicial system that I thought you might find worth considering and, well, yea, verily, even possibly worth discussing. Okay? The note from Harry is as follows. Dear Bob, and by Dear Bob he means Dear Bob and all the Horn family commune, I'm not a name dropper by temperament, but I was fascinated when I heard that a federal district judge in D.C. had granted a preliminary injunction against the NSA in its ongoing data collection program, a preliminary ruling to prevent them from retrieving metadata from Verizon, a suit brought by an admittedly conservative and gadfly Larry Klayman. Larry Klayman is also the one who, isn't he the one who's calling for the American Revolution to oust that one from our White House? Isn't that the same guy? Second American Revolution? That if Barack Obama hadn't quit the premises of the White House by November something, that he was going to call down the wrath of Zeus? Or I don't know. But, yeah. Anyway, Harry continues, the mainstream media's initial take on this seemed to be only about sound bites. Judge Leon was appointed by Republican George W. Bush. Or, Judge Leon's ruling doesn't matter much because many judges have reviewed parts of the NSA activities. Or, Larry Klayman is an unpredictable Washington gadfly whose lawsuit is not as serious as a similar lawsuit filed by the ACLU. Seemed to be serious enough to get the attention of Judge Leon. But then again, that's the for-profit media for you. If you're looking for in-depth analysis, the TV box is probably the wrong place to go looking for it. From any perspective, be it liberal, well, there's really not any liberal, there aren't any liberals on the TV box. Unless you've got one of those cable systems that still carries Amy Goodman. But anyway, or conservative. All they know how to do is report horse races, statistics, and sort of seventh grade, he likes her, she doesn't like him, we like them, but we don't like the other people, sort of craptastic social BS. Harry continues. But I suspect that none of these soundbite reporters has observed Judge Leon up close. I did, once, and I was deeply impressed by the man. About 2 years ago, when I still lived in Washington, D.C., I was called to serve on federal court jury duty. If one lives in D.C., one is on the jury duty list for both D.C. and the federal court system. Although I have never served on either a D.C. court jury or a federal court jury for various reasons, although I once got as far as being initially placed on a jury, before the defendant's lawyer used one of her peremptory challenges to remove me. But about 2 years ago, I was summoned for federal court jury duty, which in D.C. meant that you can be called any time during a two-week period to appear and be part of a jury pool of about 50 to 75 people. And pay attention to this account, because I think you're going to be fascinated by it. During this particular jury summons period, I was asked to appear in my second week of my jury service, and the case that I was in a jury pool for was before Judge Richard Leon, about whom I knew nothing at the time. The particular case that was going to trial was a drug case. The defendant was a relatively young woman who was both small in height and thin in weight. She looked like a lost soul to me, although I realized that appearances can be deceiving. Her clothes were not at all impressive. Indeed, she seemed dressed on the edge of shabbiness. And if you watch high-profile trials on TV, you know that lawyers always want their clients to look presentable, if even well-groomed and nice-looking. And she was not particularly well-groomed. Moreover, she was the only defendant, and she was being represented by a female public defender, perhaps in her late 30s. In D.C., the public defender service is a full-time job, and this public defender seemed quite competent and savvy, but this public defender was working alone. She had no one else at her lawyer's table. There's no second chair. Lawyers tend to describe their tables at trial as if it were the violin section of the Boston Pops. You know, there's first chair and second chair and third chair. Well, she had no second chair. The prosecutor, who was male, who by federal law is one of the many assistant attorneys general for Washington, D.C., was also an adult in his prime, perhaps also in his late 30s. He also seemed quite able, and he seemed to be determined to do something. He did not strike me as a gentle or highly sensitive man. Although, as you know, I am an attorney by training and bar membership, that status is not considered particularly remarkable in D.C., because there are so many, oh, so many, attorneys who live in the District of Columbia. The federal government, the D.C. government, and both law firms and lobbying firms employ countless people who have qualifications as a lawyer. So I was not excluded by the initial questions that in a D.C. federal court the judge asks of everyone as a group. However, the more I sat there in Judge Leon's courtroom thinking about the situation, the more I began to wonder why the federal government was prosecuting this case. The charges against this young, diminutive-looking woman were for either possession or distribution of an illegal drug. I believe it was cocaine. That's all she was being prosecuted for. And yet the federal government was going to trial. They were going to trial to punish this woman, who may, like many D.C. residents, have been involved in drugs in order to have money to live on, or perhaps to feed a long-term drug habit. Either way, I began to think about the salaries of the prosecutor and government-salaried public defender, the salary of a federal district judge like Judge Leon, and the costs to the court system of this whole going to trial. And I realized that I myself definitely would have preferred that all this money be spent on helping this woman, perhaps even finding her a job and giving her something else to live for other than drugs. The more I thought about the charges against her and the more I saw this federal court machinery in action, the more I realized that this was a form of madness. And although I certainly had feelings about the legitimacy of other trials where I was more quickly eliminated from the jury pool, this was the first time that I realized, down deep, that I was opposed to this trial taking place. I realized, rather, that there was most likely no point in prosecuting or punishing this woman for her conduct, based on the charges and based on my observations of the defendant during the voir dire. Voir dire is that part of the process where the lawyers question the members of the jury, the judge questions the potential members of the jury, and people are weeded out for biases, things like that. So when the opportunity came up for the judge, this was Judge Leon, asked, as judges always do, if there were jurors who had other problems or objections to serving on the jury, I raised my hand and was put on a list of people who would be asked to come to the judge's bench and discuss my problems in front of the judge and the prosecutor and the public defender. My turn came, and I wondered how this federal judge would respond to my concerns about the futility and wasted cost of prosecuting a woman who would possibly be helped far more by money spent on social and medical services, or even job coaching and a nice new business suit for job interviews. I've had a number of dealings with federal judges, for reasons I won't discuss here, but I've found that some of them are or become arrogant, if not sometimes narcissistic. Someone I knew back in D.C. used to refer to it as a disease called robitis, an arrogance and superiority that one acquires when one puts on a black robe every day at work. And there's an entire separate discussion to be had about why judges persist in wearing that arcanery. Black robe? Well, that's a direct throwback to the fact that courts were initially functions of the church. Hell, why not a toga? A bearskin loincloth and a stone knife. You see? but that's me, not Harry. Harry says, so I was nervous about talking to this federal judge about my personal qualms, and I started my explanation when called up to the bench by obsequiously emphasizing that I did not intend by my concerns to offend Judge Leon and his court. Immediately, he surprised me by smiling, shaking his head, and saying, no offense taken whatsoever. I then explained, this is a moment. This really is. I then explained to the judge, who looked at me quite thoughtfully, that I simply could not serve on this jury because I did not believe this trial was a productive way to deal with this defendant or her situation. I said that I saw no reason for resources to be spent on this kind of probably unconstructive legal process, and I was still nervous because as a lawyer I'm ostensibly an officer of the court, and here I was saying that this trial would not accomplish anything good. Because, see, prosecutors, and this is me, not Harry, prosecutors love to say, well, we've got a 99% conviction rate here, and we put away a lot of criminal defendants in the last year. And when you're in the federal system, that allows your boss, the attorney general, to say, the administration is tough on crime. Right? So Harry continues, and having dug myself into a hole, or so I worried, I finished my digging work by saying that I simply could not imagine voting to convict this defendant, even if there was factual evidence of what she was charged with. At this point, the public defender, who I imagine was baffled, or at least startled, by a middle-aged man who had just announced he would not vote guilty under any circumstances, asked me to repeat what I just said. So I did. The judge, still behaving with quiet grace and flawless politeness, finally asked the prosecutor if he wanted to have me excused. I was physically squeezed in the middle, the prosecutor on the left of me, the public defender on my right. Well, at this point, I was too nervous even to observe who did what, but what I remember is that the judge and the prosecutor ultimately agreed that I should be excused. You see, the criminal justice system in this country cannot afford to have on its juries people who believe that maybe exercising our national punishment fetish is not the best way to deal with violations of the law, any more than would be flogging or the dunking chair or the stocks or throwing rotten vegetables at them or seeing if they weigh the same as a duck, any of that, because it's all a load of arcane horseshit with very little reason for it beyond, cue up Fiddler on the Roof tradition. So back to what Harry writes. He says, and without saying or doing anything that would make me feel ashamed or deficient or humiliated, Judge Leon informed me that I had been excused and was free to go and report back to the jury room. Although that was my last instance of jury service in Washington, D.C. before I moved to Balmer 11 months ago, that experience was by far my most positive experience as a potential juror. I should add that there were other judges, both D.C. and federal judges, who clearly intended to be hospitable and fair with potential jurors. But I am not exaggerating when I say that Judge Richard Leon was by far the most empathetic and respectful judge whom I ever observed as a potential juror. And so when I read that Judge Richard Leon had granted a preliminary injunction against certain parts of the NSA's data collection program, I was not surprised. As a trained lawyer, I know that there are plenty of legal processes and maneuvering before Judge Leon has the chance to rule on a permanent injunction, and perhaps his ruling, whatever it is, will be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But to anyone who wonders why Judge Leon, who was appointed to the D.C. Federal District Court in 2001 by George W. Bush, I would say, look at the man. Look at what his conscience has influenced him to do in other decisions that seem to be extraordinarily fair, considering who appointed him. Especially that last part, considering who appointed him. And that is not to say, I'll add editorially to Harry's remarks, that the young woman who was before the bar charged with something that would probably send her to some sort of federal facility on the taxpayer's dime and accomplish absolutely no good whatsoever, that's not to say that she was not prosecuted to the full extent of the law and within an inch of her life. I think Harry would say that she probably was. Harry continues, above all, I would say, don't judge a judge by his robe. Be a potential juror who thinks that the trial is senseless and see how the judge reacts. postscript. Several months ago on Constitution Day, I attended a program given by the ACLU on the issue of why the U.S. has such a large percentage of its population in prison, the largest percentage of any nation in the world, by the way. Editorially, that's what we call the prison industrial complex in the United States. One of the panelists was Baltimore resident David Simon, the creator of the TV show The Wire. At one point near the end of the program, Mr. Simon suggested that maybe people should engage in so-called jury nullification, where a jury will refuse to convict despite the existence of sufficient factual evidence to compel a jury to find that a defendant has broken the law. When the program ended, I went up to the stage and told him that I thought that people should refuse to participate earlier, as I had done in D.C. federal court as a juror who said that the trial was a waste of human and economic resources. Although I have a lot of respect for Mr. Simon, he asked me if I had read so-and-so's book on jury nullification, and I told him I was talking about potential jurors expressing their consciences even before they were put on a jury. Much to my surprise, he didn't seem to completely understand what I was saying. I will excuse him, however, since the ACLU people kept dragging him away for photo opportunities and may not have had the ability to focus on what I was saying, such is often the case at these sorts of meet-and-greet soirees. Closing, though, Harry says, but I say to the Horn Family Commune, the fact is that there is no point in telling a judge that you can be fair if, in fact, you don't feel that way. In my humble opinion, one is not at all disrespecting the jury system by telling the judge that you just don't feel you can vote to convict a particular defendant. In fact, I suspect that many potential jurors are too polite to express their true feelings to the judge when they are sitting there in a courtroom as part of a jury pool. Indeed, even for lawyers, a courtroom is the kind of environment that makes even the most confident people nervous. And perhaps most judges in the U.S. are not like Judge Richard Leon. But think about how much fairer our state and federal trials would be if every judge were as gracious and as respectful to potential jurors with consciences as Judge Richard Leon was to me. Indeed. Consider the sort of country we would have if we did not run around trying to prosecute poor people for, in essence, the crime of being poor. Because I know of very few people who have just jumped out there into the life of paranoia and fear that is encompassed within, say, the drug trade, because they were leading a life of indolent boredom. Not many at all. We have a broken judicial system. It's not just broken on the criminal side. It's broken on the civil side as well. Massive amounts of money go into preventing people who have been injured or tormented or poisoned or killed by, capitalism, from having their day in court. There is a constant drumbeat of personal responsibility and tort reform that swept over this country. You may recall the woman who was burned by McDonald's coffee with third-degree burns over her legs and genital area and lower abdomen, and the fun that right-wing radio and right-wing TV and right-wing writers and right-wingers in general had. And she got $1 million for getting burnt by coffee, and she's stupid. See, our jury system's out of whack. But they weren't sitting there, and they weren't instructed by the jury, and they did by the court as a jury. They weren't informed as the jury was in that case that McDonald's had been warned time after time after time after time after time that their coffee was too hot, and was bound to sooner or later hurt someone because it was boiling hot. But food scientists, how would you like to be one of those, working in the employ of McDonald's, Inc., had determined that the smell of coffee was best disseminated at those high temperatures, and that when the coffee smell permeated more broadly, more people bought coffee. So there was a deliberate and intentional decision made to continue serving coffee at that temperature so as to sell more coffee, so as to make more money, so as to make the shareholders of McDonald's, Inc. happier. For all intents and purposes, they knew they were going to maim someone, and they said, well, F it, we're making money, which should probably be on our money. F it, we're making money, motto of the United States, which is sort of a roundabout way of saying what the unofficial motto of the United States really is. The business of America is business. So our judicial system is, in fact, broken. I'm sure you've seen the story of the kid who killed four people and maimed a couple of others, drunk out of his mind at 16 years old, who was given a walk, who was given 10 years of probation instead of any prison time whatsoever, because the defense was mounted. Well, the defense is being referred to now in the press as affluenza. In other words, the kid had been raised rich. No one had ever told him no. He had never suffered any consequences for his actions, and that affluence was blamed for the fact that he barreled into four people, killed into a crowd of people, killed four, maimed two. And the judge said, "Well, you're a nice little feller. We'll put you on probation for 10 years. You don't need to do any pen time. A fine young man like you, you got a good lawyer, you got good parents. Don't do it again, and you'll be on probation for 10 years. All right, good. Go and sin no more." No small amount of outrage was caused by that decision, and rightfully so. But now, the victim's families are suing his family, and hopefully will decrease a little bit of their incidence of inter-family or intra-family affluenza. Of course, no one has really successfully mounted a defense of povertosis. It's been tried, God knows. You can argue to a jury until hell freezes over that circumstances of poverty, which lead to circumstances of desperation, which lead to, among other things, ignorance, poor education, poor health care, poor health decisions, poor social decisions, a general lack of understanding of the rules of decent society, that all these contribute to stupid criminal acts. Juries do not buy. In fact, we got another case on this Titanic Tuesday of the jury system going sideways. A teacher by the name of Lillian Gomez, who taught at Sunrise Elementary School in Kissimmee, Florida. She was in charge of teaching young children. Some of you probably already know this. Maybe some don't. One of her young students, her young charges, was autistic. And he had a habit, and because of the way the brain is wired, we really can't explain how the brain works in an autism situation, or even in an Asperger's situation, but this was an autism situation. And for some reason or another, the child was fixated upon eating crayons. Generally, that's not harmful to you. At least they weren't before the great global trade explosion that wound up having everything we own, everything we purchase, made in slave labor camps and sweatshops in China. I mean, those of us of a certain age probably know of someone that we spent kindergarten or first grade with, if it was not us ourselves, who had a taste for paste. It was kind of minty and, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. Or crayon eaters or pencil chewers. There's a lot of stress that comes with entering the school process, isn't there? I remember some of those kids. Hell, I remember me. But this particular child, well, anyway, since the capitalistic floodgates opened from China, we have found out that they put all kinds of poisons in all kinds of stuff that shouldn't have any poison in it. Things like infant formula or your old Roy dog food from down to the Wally World, where, you know, you can buy a 50-pound bag of old Roy and the next thing you know, old Roy's gone old Yeller. And yes, there really is old Yeller brand dog food, which I'm sure also comes from China. Hey, remember the spate of pets dying? Yeah, right. I mean, we've got Chinese smoked sow's ears that certainly are not silk purses and may not even be sow's ears. They may be the ears of very large rats. And so, too, it was with crayons. Off-brand crayons made in China, and God knows what's in them, because capitalism has run absolutely amok over there, and, well, you know, regulation's bad for business, and you know, job-killing regulations. Yeah. So this child had a habit of chewing on crayons. Enter Lillian Gomez, who has a brilliant idea. Now, this was a young child because the crayons she was dealing with were the large jumbo-type crayons. You know what I'm talking about. And Lillian Gomez was determined to break her young autistic student's habit of crayon chewing, by God. So she took some of the jumbo-sized crayons and soaked them for a month. Well, days at least, in hot sauce. Then she let them dry off and put them into a little plastic baggie that she had labeled with the child's name. And the child did what we could expect the child would do. The child chewed the crayons. You can imagine the tears. You can imagine the horror. Some of us like spicy food. Some of us like spicy things. And there's a thrill. There's even apparently an endorphin release when the heat gets up so high and the sweat pops out on your forehead and you get that burn, and the burn won't go away, and you can't make them. You just got to ride the heat. Some of us like that. I'm one of those people. But it is very seldom you can get a child to eat spicy food. One works one's way into it slowly. The same way one introduces other elements of cuisine and flavor and aroma into a diet. But when it broke that Lillian Gomez had essentially poisoned her own student with hot sauce, bless their hearts, the Osceola County School District did the right thing. They fired her. Because what school district wants a human being as vicious as Lillian Gomez in your school system? Now, Lillian Gomez did deny that she actually force-fed the crayons to the child. She probably didn't have to. The child had a compulsion. But the fact that the compulsion was a compulsion, that the behavior was compulsive, also mitigates against thinking that you're going to break it by poisoning and harming the child. Lillian Gomez, upon being canned, appealed her dismissal. And then the school district appealed to keep her out of the classroom and away from little children, others of whom she might poison. You know, you don't have to die. You don't have to be rendered unconscious or unfunctional to have been poisoned. Her lawyer said that she poisoned the child to deter the student from eating art supplies. And because, well, you know, those crayons, they're a gateway art supply, and you can go from gnawing crayons, the next thing you know, little feller's over there gnawing on the frame of a frame of a stretched canvas, just like a beaver. School district spokeswoman Dana Schaefer said, "We lost the appeal, so by law we have to comply by the courts. We don't want to come out and say anything bad about the teacher or say anything to worry parents." You don't really have to, Dana. Because it turns out Lillian Gomez, by order of the court, is being placed by the school district at a different elementary school. And at that elementary school, she will once again have access to special needs students. I support teachers. I support teachers' unions wholeheartedly. But what a nightmare is this case. The appeals judge disagreed with the Osceola County School District, disagreed that Lillian Gomez's effectiveness had been severely impaired. The appeals judge said her conduct was not so egregious as to merit the court upholding her firing. Her lawyer, Thomas Egan, tried, as lawyers will, to put the best face on a bad situation and said, "I think she made a bad judgment in the way she went about it, but her purpose was good." And which purpose then, O noble pleader, was that? The Autism Society was not quite so charitable. They said, "There are also hundreds of school teachers and professionals across the country who can handle challenging behaviors such as PICA, which is eating inedible objects, in a sensitive, human manner that upholds the dignity of each child. A behavior like eating crayons in a child with autism should not automatically be viewed as a delinquent behavior." And apparently there's a thing out there among sadistic teachers for hot sauce. The story that I'm looking at from ABC News notes that a Miami teacher in 2009 was convicted of abuse after she allowed a special needs student to drink a soda laced with hot sauce. Well, two people does not a trend make. But in what universe does the content of that story remotely resemble justice? I would submit that it doesn't. By the way, going back to the whole business of judges in robes, Ron and Raleigh writes, "The reason for the robe is that they wear it because they can more easily conceal their shooting arms." Oh, you mean they're freedom protectors? By the way, you will want to hear this. This just in from Kevin in Colorado Springs. Bob, I just got off the phone with Bill, Mr. Stress. It was a week ago tonight that he had his medical crisis. Kevin says, I just got off the phone with Bill. He sounds really good today, much better than Sunday when he seemed confused a lot. Today he was fully coherent and telling me his usual stories and generally sounding very good. He says to tell everyone he is alive and well and awaiting the time when he can hear the show again. He tells me they're looking to send him to a rehab place for a few days, and he's found a friend whose father has a moving service that's going to donate the move whenever that is now. So I'm pleasantly surprised at how well Bill sounded today and happy over that. So that's our Bill update. And no, Kevin, you might have come in the middle of that. That wasn't my refusal, and it wasn't a refusal to serve jury duty. That was Harry's in D.C. And it was far more a story about flaws in the judicial system than about an outright sort of Bartleby the Scrivener, I prefer not to kind of civil disobedience. So I will extend in your name to Harry your congratulations. Ron and Raleigh also pointing out, since we went back, we were talking about the NSA decision, Larry Klayman is the Yahoo that filed the suit that caused the rats to gut Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. A real patriot. Politics makes for strange, and we do mean strange bedfellows. But just as a reminder, this is Titanic Tuesday, in which we celebrate the Titanic wit of the right wing. And it turns out there's rather a lot of them to celebrate this evening. Somehow it seems there always is. A lot of them. Are a lot of them. A little crap storm that Ku Klux Klan Ladies Auxiliary Exalted Cyclopette Kleeget. Yeah, let's make her a Kleeget. Maybe a Grand Wizardress. Megyn Kelly got started, will not go away. No matter how hard we try. You may recall on Friday that I became rather wrought at the fact that John Stewart had used the Megyn Kelly Santa is white thing, idiocy, to in turn make great sport with an assertion that all West Virginians, including me, Agnes, our children, our grandchildren, were all, every last one of us, racists. You may recall that I didn't take too kindly to that. Well, lo and behold, in the middle of the night, somebody, and you know, we've got a lot of pseudonyms around here and handles on email and things like that, but generally speaking, we know who we are. But last night at 12:57 a.m. Eastern, well, this morning at 12:57 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I received a note from someone who calls him or herself Blue Ruffian, whom I've never heard from before, at least not under that guise. Right now, you are sounding like an absolute jackass with your John rants. John rants? Seldom rant about the John. Oh, John Stewart. Point could have been taken in a calm demeanor, not your self-righteous tough guy rant. Yeah, that's me, see? Tough guy. Flicking a nickel right here, even as I speak, catching it in the palm of my hand and re-flicking it, just like George Raft, because I'm a tough guy, see? And let me remind you that you do some of the best jokes on your own West Virginia folk. Kettle Black? Signed, Blue Ruffian. Well, not really. Just sent from my iPad. So I responded. Because I wanted to make it clear that by responding the way I did to John Stewart and using the F word as I did, I only did that because all New Jersey people talk like that. That's the way New Jersey people are. Just like all West Virginians are racists. All New Jersey people use the F word, you know, pass the effing salt. Let me see the effing sports page. I got to drive to the effing grocery store. All New Jersey people, of which John Stewart is one, speak that way. See? See? And when you can, and, you know, just to explain myself, when you can do that and you have tremendous comic wit, well, that's just a double bonus. When you can dehumanize an entire group of some of the most put upon, poverty stricken, bedraggled, undereducated people in the United States in one fell swoop, in a joke that has nothing to do with Appalachia to begin with, except for the fact that you made it about it, well, it's comedy gold. But I could not resist responding to the line from Blue Ruffian about Kettle Black. No, Kettle not black. Ma and Pa Kettle were historically white people. So there. But that being the case, no, the Santa thing will not go, as they would say in New Jersey, the F away. What do I mean? Well, this goes back to last Friday. Honest to Pete. You wonder what goes on inside certain privileged people's minds. I mean, this is too daggum much. I get alerts to stories posted over at Americans Against the Tea Party. Nick Goroff posted this story on the 14th of December. And it has to do with an incident at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Now, you may recall that New Mexico is that place where you can be taken off for repeated body cavity searches, including enemas and colonoscopies, because an untrained drug dog alerted on the seat of your automobile. indicating that you, by God, were carrying drugs in your butt. Well, at least that isn't what at least that is not what happened in this story. No, in this particular instance at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, a young man by the name of Christopher Rougier. In French, it would be Rougier, but I'm pretty sure that's not it. Christopher Rougier is from a mixed-race family. And so when students at his high school, because, you know, we want to make sure there's no war on Christmas at Rio, at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, were invited to dress up in celebration of the holiday season, Christopher Rougier decided to dress up as the jolly old elf himself. Santa Claus. Sinterklaas. In Dutch. The Claus part comes from the Nikolaus Claus. We're just knocking off the Nick on front, in the front. Sinterklaas. That Dutch has nothing to do with this. But he decided to dress up as Santa Claus. Others of his friends dressed as elves. Still more friends dressed as reindeer. And a teacher told young Christopher, because school is, after all about learning, Christopher, don't you know that Santa Claus is white? Why are you wearing that? Well, at least she didn't make him eat hot sauce laced peppermint sticks. Hell, those might be tasty. So, while the teacher's name has not been released, so we will never know if he or she does it again, the Rio Rancho School District says that the teacher has, in fact, been disciplined. But we don't know how. But we do know that if the teacher was disciplined in Osceola County, Florida, some judge, probably suffering a terrible case of what Harry refers to as robitis, would declare that it was no big damn deal and that the person should be reinstated and given access to children again. Sheesh. Is there anywhere in this country that is safe? Jesus, it's like Laurence Olivier. Is it safe? I don't know. I obviously don't know. Irish Dave noting, I'm guessing the Washington Post has already composed Judge Leon's obituary. Just saying. Oh, they've got a huge, and it's kind of gross. It's called a morgue. You pre-write people's obituaries. That's why they were able to get an obituary out so quickly for both Peter O'Toole and Tom Laughlin of Billy Jack fame. They're there. Ron and Raleigh, with an observation. Obviously, we are wrong about poverty. I read this article and just about dropped a log. This piece expresses the new meme put forth by the right and some third-way Democrats. These lazy bums need to get off their asses and get to hauling on those bootstraps. It is, of course, from the Chicago Tribune, with which no self-respecting parrot would allow his cage to be lined. If you're a low how to combat income inequality. If you're a low-income African-American with a talent for braiding hair, really? We're not even through the first clause of the first sentence? If you're a low-income African-American with a talent for braiding hair, you might have the idea of making money that way. You could start out doing it for relatives and friends and gradually build a clientele that could provide a decent income without a lot of capital. It could offer a way out of poverty and into the middle class. But in many states, including Illinois, it's not so simple. If you want to braid hair professionally, you must be a licensed cosmetologist. And to get that license, you have to get 1,500 hours of training. A poor woman who wants to pick up a little cash off the books can usually get away with it. But if she hopes to earn a living and can't afford the training, she's out of luck. You can see where this is going. It's all about job-killing regulations and the nanny state. I will never forget a couple of years ago, coming up on three now, when we were kindly sent on the Libboat cruise. Our first port of call was Grand Turk in the Turks and Caicos Islands. It's sort of a southern fringe of the Bahamas, I believe, although it is a separate political entity. We docked at Grand Turk, and while Ferg and I went off in search of adventure and found it in the form of street food, fried conch fritters, fried plantains, things like that. It was delicious. Agnes and the girls found their adventure in hanging out on the beach and letting their first experience of Caribbean sunshine fall upon them. And in that instance, no sooner had the cruise ship disgorged its passengers than there were a bevy of young people, young women, who were all lined up to braid up the tourist women's hair. Not being sexist, I mean, that's just mostly who got it done. Braid up the tourist women's hair and make them all look like Brooke Shields. Or no, not Brooke Shields. Come on, what's her name? The movie, 10. She's a right-winger now. Yeah, we'll remember it in a minute. Wait, where did I get Brooke Shields? No, every adolescent of a certain age had that poster alongside Farrah Fawcett on his wall. You know who I'm talking about. And lo and behold, there they were. They were all entrepreneurs, free to pursue their trade in glorious free market. Oh, Jesus. You get the idea. Bo Derek, thank you, Darlene. Thank you. I hate it when that happens. Yeah, Bo Derek. Remember with the braided hair and the little beads? And I mean, it was cool. It was lovely. But that doesn't strike me. I mean, maybe it works on Grand Turk, but I guess these right-wingers at the Chicago Tribune maybe want one person offering to squeegee your window at traffic intersections while another person on the other side is offering to braid your passenger's hair. So I'm not demeaning the art. I'm simply suggesting that we're not going to change the present new normal of 7% unemployment by teaching everybody to braid each other's hair. It's rather of a Sneetch's problem, isn't it? So there you go. Like I said, we get busy. We get busy on these Titanic Tuesdays, especially when we miss more in Monday, the evening before. So we'll take a little break, open up the lines, 304-658-3333. Jump right in if you want to add to the Titanic Tuesday list. Or jump in on Skype. Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. Bob Kincaid Horn is how you reach me on Skype if you've never sent in a request, just send it to me. I'll okay it, and we'll be talking before you know it. This is The Horn.
Smoking with the boys upstairs when I heard about
Love that song. Love that band. This is The Horn. It is 8 minutes past 7 p.m. here on the in the Eastern time zone. And Titanic Tuesday is so thoroughly underway. I'm going to throw something out there that I tweeted and Facebooked over the weekend. And I fear that at this point, I mean, I'm not just trying to be a curmudgeon here. But I do. I mean, when I'm funning around, everybody knows it. And when I'm being serious, everybody, I think, knows it. Oh, by the way, thank you, Asa, for getting us started this evening. Asa has us $10 down the road, much appreciated, toward this evening's fundraising goal. 14 more, like Asa, and we will be done for the evening. Like I said, I am not by any means trying to be some sort of grammar nerd or word stalker, or I don't even know what pejorative to attach to this. But maybe it's because I'm just paying more attention to it, but I seem to see more and more instances of just plain old-fashioned shoddy use of the English language. Some of them are funny, even though they come from horrifying situations. This, for instance, is a story about a botched drug raid. Here we go again. Our nation's punishment fetish, our desperate clinging to the failed war on drugs. And another dead human being. Well, maybe not dead yet. What can you say about someone who is shot in the head? The story comes out of Chillicothe, Ohio. And yeah, it's a drug raid. And just a gentle reminder how it is, for instance, the account that we started out with from Harry, how it is that a young woman, thin, not particularly well-kempt, not particularly well-dressed, but also not looking particularly threatening, winds up clasped in the jaws of the federal prosecutorial criminal justice system. Well, the answer is that Congress likes to pass tough-on-crime laws and then go back home to the home district, stand on the hustings, and say, "I'm tough on crime." This is politically easy. It is socially devastating. It was around 10:30 p.m. on the 11th day of December when a law enforcement unit calling itself the U.S. 23 Task Force, U.S. 23 is a highway, by the way. You might recall a saying and, in fact, a song, "Readin', Writin', and Route 23. It was said that the hillbillies would take Route 23 up into the Midwest to find work in places like Akron, Cleveland, Dayton, so forth. So the U.S. 23 Task Force swarms a home. It's a single wide trailer with a wooden deck leading up to the front door. Snow was on the ground. And Sergeant Brett McKnight, 11-year veteran of the Ross County Sheriff's Office, according to a website called Police State USA, mishandled his weapon. The weapon fired. The bullet, as you can imagine, was not stopped by anything like the insulation or the vinyl siding or anything else. Traveled through the exterior wall of the home and into the brains of Crystal Marie Barrows, aged 35, of Chillicothe. Yes, she died the following day. There was no gunfire from inside the home. No one resisted the U.S. 23 Task Force. And six people were arrested for what Police State USA refers to as prohibition crimes. You know. Crystal Barrows had three children, three boys, aged 19, 14, and 9. She had no criminal convictions, no criminal record in Ross County, Ohio, outside a misdemeanor conviction for disorderly conduct by intoxication. Sergeant Brett McKnight, the 11-year veteran of the Ross County Sheriff's Department, has been placed on administrative leave. He will continue to draw both his breath and his pay, neither of which Crystal Barrows will be drawing. A lot of editorializing in this account. And this is a damnably serious story. It's heartrending. It is all too common. And I would simply ask the question, does a serious story not deserve a serious attempt to convey the facts? I'm going to share with you, in a matter of seconds, the lead sentence from this account from Police State USA, who appear to be attempting to do good work by pointing out the manifest failures of the long-since-lost war on drugs. The American drug war claimed another casualty when a woman was shot in the head while sitting on a couch by an incompetent police officer who fired his weapon through an exterior wall prior to raiding the home. Here we have an account of the absolute shattering, the destruction of the known universe for one individual and what remains of a world being left in wreckage for her three sons, aged 9, 14, and 19. And before they can even begin to tell the story, the person typing this, who has apparently no editor, no one to stop them and say, "Hey, wait a minute. Let's get this right first." Hits publish after, because clarity means something. The way this is written, it sounds like the officer was sitting beside the victim on a couch, fired his weapon through an exterior wall of the house somehow, and managed to hit the woman sitting next to him in the head with a bullet. Something like this happens in this once trying to be great nation daily. It seems it's getting to the point where it happens hourly. And we, in our capacity as people who are attempting to be informed on the nature of the dysfunction that suffuses this country, need to have adequately presented, accurately expressed facts with which to inform ourselves. The American drug war claimed another casualty when a woman was shot in the head while sitting on a couch by an incompetent police officer who fired his weapon through an exterior wall prior to raiding the home. That's the first comma. Officer, comma, who? Maybe I'm just being an elitist. But how do you write this? And there's no name attached to it, so we don't know who the person who is not particularly... It just says by PSUSA. At the bottom of the article, they say, demand that the sheriff back off the drug war and teach his officers some beginner-level firearm safety. Sergeant Brett McKnight should not get special treatment for his mistake. Well, hell's bells, how is it not willful, wanton, reckless level manslaughter? It's obviously not murder, because there's no premeditation and there's no heat of passion. But God Almighty, it dishonors the victims when we rush to our outrage before we can formulate an expression of it. By the way, Jan pointing out in the chat room that over the weekend, which was the one-year anniversary of the slaughter at Newtown, there was a man who walked into a Walmart Sunday morning and then shot himself and killed himself. Nobody else was hurt. And this happened near Nellis Air Force Base. Jeez. We got lots of stuff like that. Because it's America. And we love guns more than life. And we love guns more than children. And we love guns more than grandmothers. And we love guns more than fathers, guns more than mothers. We love guns more than we love ourselves. And in the year since the slaughter at Newtown, there has been not one serious attempt at making the next Newtown not happen. And as far as I can tell, there never will be. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Dave.
Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, that justice system is really it's scary dealing with it.
Well, justice is strictly Orwellian in this instance, and it is certainly not anything that one would respect or recognize as the dictionary definition or even the philosophical definition of justice.
Yeah, well, I don't know, the way I see it, it's been that way a long, long time. I remember back when I lived in Los Angeles, in the aftermath of the Rodney King beating. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
We had it on. That was like our first video beating we ever. Now people just, you know, that stuff happens all the time. But I got a letter from the Superior Court of Los Angeles. I was living down there. And got a letter from the Superior Court of Los Angeles, and it was a jury summons, and I tossed it in the trash. And I a few months went by, and I got another one, and I tossed it. I didn't want to do a jury. It was a jury summons. I just didn't want to do it, so I just threw it away. And I got a third one. It was a yellow envelope, and it said, you know, it had the form letter in it that had a check mark on a warrant will be issued for your arrest if you do not appear. I always respond to those. But
it's a good idea.
Yeah. But I had to report to the criminal courts building in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the infamous criminal courts building down there, and it's from my house in Sherman Oaks out in the valley, in the San Fernando Valley. It was like a 22-mile drive to the criminal courts building. Anyway, so I went down, and I appeared at the criminal courts building, and it's like where the Manson was tried there, and OJ hadn't been tried yet. That was before OJ, but I showed up, and, you know, we would shuttle around to courtrooms, and actually, you know, one of the experiences I had on the side on that was I got to really see downtown Los Angeles, because they give you a two-hour lunch, and I'd go out and walk around old L.A. and Alvera Street. And have you been to Los Angeles?
Never. Someday.
Well, it's amazing because there's some ancient buildings not far from the courthouse there. Alvera Street, which is like, I think it's like Pueblo de Los Angeles, goes back to the early 19th century. It's the trip. But anyway, back to the court thing. They shuttled us around to all these cases, and finally we landed on this one where they were doing this murder case, and it was kind of scary. I was amazed. I was meeting some of the other jurors, and they all seemed like they really wanted to get on this jury, and I was a little bit scared about the situation because it was like right after Rodney King, but before the riots. And there was a real tension there, I think, throughout the city, at least in my mind it was. And this was a gangland shooting, the basic details, I don't know. But the prosecutor was this woman. It was, Marsha Clark was the prosecutor. And, you know, they were putting us through this voir dire, and when I had my chance to go up for the voir dire, I was, you know, they had told us facts about the case, like, you know, would you be in a position to believe people that had been brought out of prison as witnesses, da da da. Would you be the victim was an obese person, so they said, are you, you know, do you have any prejudice against obese people? All kinds of just strange questions. But when I got up there to the voir dire, I did not want to be on this jury because these guys were really treacherous-looking fellows, and it was, as they say, like a really, really tense time. And I just said to the judge, I said, you know, with all the stuff that's going on now, I don't know who you want me to believe, the police, who, you know, what's going on with the police now, or people you're bringing out of prison. And they excused me from the jury. Marsha Clark just said, you can go. She let me go. But it was just, that was my first experience on a jury. And I just, you know, I didn't, I don't know. I just didn't feel like the system was really, I was afraid of these guys anyway. I was just, there was so much racial.
Well, to look at another case though, Dave, consider if a 16-year-old kid can mow down six individuals and then have the defense successfully claim that he only did it because
he was too rich and his parents had never told him no. You know, that's disconcerting and disgusting on its face.
Oh, absolutely.
But it speaks to something even at an even deeper level. There have been cultures where the rich or the privileged were encouraged to go out and terrorize those who were not. And they've happened several times. And none of those cultures that allow that to happen end well.
No, well, I think we have a lot of that in our culture. That's what the Klan was all about. But I was going to say that, you know, nowadays, it's like hearing a case like this one with a kid where he killed these people. I read about that, a number of stories about that. That's just like, I feel like I'm totally on the other side. Like, I really have more of a sense of what the blacks in L.A. felt like in those days. And because it's like, it's a class thing now more than anything, it seems to me. I feel really a lot of, you know, fear and anger, anti-establishment feelings about...
Well, with the rise of the national security police state, things that people of color have experienced for 400 years on this continent are beginning to tangentially touch people who have long been protected by their privilege, i.e. white folks.
Right.
And so now that white privilege isn't sufficing to protect white folks, a lot of white folks are looking up and going, well, this isn't really fair, is it? And so, you know, I try to be careful about saying whom I understand or what group I... Because until it has systematically happened to someone, it's hard for that person to say, you know, I really get it. But even now, as the national security police state ramps up, which is, of course, a pretty blatant and obvious example of fascism, Dave, the worm is turning. And more in this country, ethnicity is no protection. More and more in this country, the nature of the oppression and the nature of the violence and the nature of the viciousness is entirely class-based, or you could say wealth-based or lack of wealth-based.
Yeah, I think the racial thing is just a component of it all now. If you're poor, you're screwed. And if you're going into court poor, you're screwed. You know my situation with my foreclosure right now. I've got to deal with this, and I really don't. I don't feel like I've got a good chance. I'm feeling really good.
It's grinding to be in one of those situations, and I hope there's someone out there that you can turn to and talk to about it.
Well, you know, I've talked before maybe about being an activist, and I've seen a lot of other people and made friends with a lot of other folks over the past couple of years that have been in these situations, and I've seen the whole cycle from the beginning of the foreclosure on through to the sale to the eviction, and it's pretty scary with the face, especially, you know, in the aftermath. If I could start over, that'd be great, but there's no jobs out there, and being homeless is like, you know, illegal anymore. You know, it's a crime to be poor. So that's, I mean, the way I see it. So it's been a long process. But yeah, the OJ trial was another. Just it was totally a farce, and it was such a huge media event down there in those days. And I mean, I don't know who's got faith in the justice system anymore. There is no justice in this country. I mean, unless you're rich, you have no chance.
Or unless you are a servant within it.
Oh, yeah, right. The cops have a license to kill.
So do the lawyers.
Yeah.
And you know, while it's easy to go rough on prosecutors, and we tend to view defense counsel as some sort of Atticus Finch-like, defender of the common person sort of thing, we must understand that both the defense bar and the prosecutorial bar both prosper from the nature of what passes for a criminal justice system in this country. I mean, I've got I'm sitting here looking at yet another story touching upon that issue. Consider that okay, there's this I don't know if you've run across this, but there's this phony baloney BS trope that is being propagated across the U.S. that has terrified white Fox viewers absolutely in a tizzy. It's called the knockout game. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes.
Now, there's little to no actual evidence of this as a social trend expanding pandemically across the United States. But yet, lawmakers in New York, New Jersey, and Oklahoma, well, there you go, have jumped out there to ratchet up penalties and create crimes where crimes don't exist for anyone who participates in what they deem to be the knockout game. They come with, for instance, mandatory minimum sentences. Mandatory minimums are another pernicious puzzle piece to that ongoing trend in the so-called criminal justice system, whereby you take discretion away from a sentencing judge and say that if you're busted for this, you're going away for this long because the legislature has decreed it, and the power of the administration or balancing act between mercy and justice has been removed from the hands of the court. On the one hand, we find ourselves shocked, sickened, and horrified by a judge who walks a kid on, you know, a killer kid on affluenza. But by the same token, mandatory minimums without fail fall upon the poor, those who don't have adequate access to legal counsel, those who do not have or haven't had good education. You see what I'm saying? It was back in the ray gun days when the Congress decided to create sentencing guidelines in the criminal justice system of the federal courts and took away the discretion of federal judges who serve for life at good behavior and are supposed to be on the federal bench because of their wisdom and acumen in applying the law.
Yeah.
And it's with the passage of that first round of sentencing guidelines, which are arcane and Byzantine, to say the very least, that you get the first baby steps toward the creation of the prison industrial complex, Dave.
Right. Well, it seems like, you know, going big picture here, it just seems like there's just this systematic plan to terrorize everybody that they don't lock up, shall we say. I mean, it would terrorize a large percentage of society and lock up the rest, and they'll be terrorized too on the inside. It's just, it's all over. It's really, I don't know.
And see, because we exist in a media culture that sensationalizes anything that it gets its hands on, that is so in a hurry, sort of similar to that story I read about the godforsaken slaughter of that 35-year-old woman in Ohio. Because we sensationalize these things, because we are in such an absolute tizzy to hit publish on the internet before we hit the think button, we wind up with poorly expressed stories that people then jump out there and go wild over. There is, for instance, and I hesitate, please, well, you, Dave, and anybody else, please do not, oh, God, I know by saying don't, you're gonna, but still, I'm just suggesting you don't. This is, I saw this video as a result of my son showing it to me because it has burned like wildfire through the cultural milieu in which he lives. There's a video out there of a young woman sucker punching another young woman, and it's got a bajillion views, and it is absolutely disgusting to behold. And of course, people have seen this video, and now they're screaming, "Well, by God, something's got to be done!" And you can hear the politicians saying, "We've got to protect our phony baloney jobs, gentlemen." When in fact, that particular incident was born of the fact that somebody somewhere, probably several somebodies in several somewheres, have utterly failed to be any kind of a parent, to be any kind of a member of a community, to be any kind of a teacher. It takes a lot of failures before somebody goes full-on hardcore heathen. So hopefully I haven't given enough details. Please don't go look for it. You don't want your dinner ruined.
There's millions of those videos out there. Actually, I was on YouTube, and you know when you get on the homepage of YouTube, they've always got these featured videos. And I think within the last few days or last couple of weeks at the most, I've seen a couple of those, whatever the stupid game they call it now. It's just, you know, where people are just going up and sucker punching people. And that stuff happens all the time, and it always, you know, it's always happened. But in the you know, where everyone's got a video camera in their cell phone, they can record it and put it out there, and people just, you know, are fascinated by this stupid stuff. It's so idiotic. But I don't know. It just seems like our culture and everything is just becoming a part of the themes or something. Am I wrong?
I don't know anymore, because the other side is so adept at declaring some sort of cultural collapse that I get really uncomfortable going along with the idea. Does that make any sense?
I think
there are a lot of isolated incidents of meanness, hatefulness, and stupidity that before the rise of even or broadcast journalism would never be given a second thought outside the communities in which they occurred.
Okay, I think that the right has had a big hand in dividing us all up, and I know all of these cops are big Fox watchers. But I'm talking about my own personal experience. Like, say here in Portland, Oregon, which you probably think is a very liberal town, and maybe more than other places. But there have been instances of police violence here over the past 5 years that I can think of a few instances right off the top of my head where it's just, you know, the cops are just over the top everywhere, and they have a federal investigation here, as in probably 50 other cities. They're having, you know, the Justice Department is investigating the Portland police along with the police everywhere else, it seems like, you know. It's just.
And yet they have neither the person power, the human resource power, nor the budget, nor the time to do justice to all of these things. I'm sure in Ross County, Ohio, there will be an investigation of Sergeant Triggerfinger, and you know what? I'm sure that he feels some degree of remorse for ending the universe for a 35-year-old individual who wasn't even charged with a crime. But when he manifests that there's somebody there from the police department who says, "Man, you didn't mean to. I mean, you were trying to protect the public. That's your job."
Yeah. I don't know if that's their agenda anymore, really. Protecting
no, but that, is certainly their self-sustaining internal myth.
I think most of them have enough us against them mentality now, and it feels like
this whole country is Fort Apache, the Bronx, right?
Yeah, as well. It seems like they bring these guys back from the Middle East where they've been occupying Iraq or Afghanistan or who knows where, and, you know, that's that's the job they've been trained for. So they're occupying wherever they are. They're an occupation force.
Yeah.
Scary. It's really scary. Very scary. Hey, by the way, I'm real glad that Bill got what he needed, got the attention he needed fast.
I'm so thrilled that it appears that he is making a good recovery.
Yeah, that's great. It takes a while to through those things, and he'll probably have a ways to go to get back to full 100% or whatever that means. But I remember I had called like right after that, and I just was like, oh my god, gotta get that handled fast. Gotta get him attention fast. That was the key. It was wonderful to hear that there's a couple of people there that he could depend on. That could get him the help he needed as fast as possible. But it's funny, you hear these commercials. You ever hear these commercials all the time about, like, FAST? You know what that is? You know what FAST is?
No.
It's face, arm, speech, time. So somebody has
yes. The stroke test.
But it's like they have these public service commercials out here. I've heard them before. Maybe it was on KPOJ. I used to hear those public service announcements about, you know, if you see somebody's face and they can't move their arm and their speech, which was what we picked up on over the phone, you got to time is vital. Get it handled as quick as possible. Get them to a doctor. You know, people can't, when they're going through that, they can't always act on their own. So
right.
It's good that you were able to act fast. People were able to get on that. That was awesome. But,
well, I thought it was a beautiful manifestation of the power of community.
Yeah, it was excellent. I was just getting updates from you. I appreciate them, and I know everybody else does too. But
I look forward to the day when we can sit down and have another confab some evening with Bill.
Yeah, he'll be back. I feel.
I feel really good about that statement, especially in the last 24 hours.
That's great. Yeah, and he might, you know, it's one of those, that recovery is kind of a, you know, maybe a two steps forward, one step back, but I think gradually he'll be back to his old self.
Indeed. Here. Well, Dave, it's awfully good to hear from you. I wish you the very best in your ongoing struggle, man. Try to stay strong.
Okay, I'll talk.
And know that you are in the thoughts and the minds of the Horn family.
Thank you, everybody. Talk to you later.
All right, take care, Dave. Bye. Our buddy Dave calling from Portland. Let's see. In regard to police misconduct, Ron and Raleigh with an observation. He says, here's another case of the police running with an explanation that is absolutely insane, and it comes out of Durham, North Carolina. Oh, this is going to be a Lulu. It's a Lulu. Durham police says teen shot self, family, accuses wish... No. Sometimes even when the comma's there, the guy reading it. Durham police says teen shot self. Family accuses officials of withholding facts. Durham Police Chief Jose Lopez broke his silence Wednesday on the death of a teenager in the back seat of a police car with a brief news conference that raised more questions about the November 19th incident and drew an immediate rebuke from an attorney for the teen's family. Lopez said Jesus Huerta, age 17, a student at Riverside High School, shot himself in the head while handcuffed behind his back. And yeah, the dateline on this is December 11th, 2013. During his 6-minute, 30-second press conference,
Lopez said Huerta had been searched and handcuffed before he was driven to police headquarters, where the shooting took place in the parking lot. Lopez said the gun was not a police officer's weapon. How the gun got into the patrol car and who owned it remain under investigation. Yeah, that's the Bob Ewell assertion, isn't it? Bob Ewell fell on his knife 37 times. Jeebus. About 12 minutes before the hour, and again, we are $140 away from our fundraising goal for any given evening, this particular evening. And the PayPal button and the Overland mail address are at headonradionetwork.com.
Good job, Jim. Hi.
Hello. Hey. Hello. Anybody? Okay. There's a conversation going on there that I'm not part of. Hello. Well, I hate to listen in on somebody's conversation. Let's. No. Still going on. That's the curse of not having a production staff. You get through one way or another. Now, a few minutes ago, in talking with Dave, I made an observation about things that would never be known outside of an individual community becoming suddenly nationwide news when maybe it ordinarily wouldn't be. Man bites dog stories, I guess you could call them. I do, however, take a different approach where massive multi-million dollar corporations are concerned. Because please remember, in 2013 in the United States of America, corporations are immortal persons with constitutional rights and probably fairly soon religious rights. A thing that cannot die and therefore cannot be subjected to some religious doctrine or dogma of hell or awaiting paradise is going to wind up having as many religious rights as those people who believe that if they don't dress right or say the right magic words or eat the right thing or drink the right thing, that they're going to be cast forever into a lake of eternal fire created for them by a loving God. And that by itself is creepy. But when a corporation screws up, in those instances, I believe the whole world needs to know about it, and the only possibility that we have as persons of conscience is to learn of them and act accordingly and refuse to ever have anything to do with them again. Dateline, Nash Vegas. The chain is a very upscale one. Morton's Steakhouse. Maybe they've changed their name since I knew about it. I ate at a Morton's once upon a time, a million years ago, in Atlanta, Georgia. At that point in time, it was known as Morton's of Chicago. This was one of those trendy upscale steakhouses. We ain't talking no Ponderosa nor Bonanza here. That caters to people who want to spend insanely large amounts of money on meat. I am not being critical of the meat eaters, as I are one. But it's the kind of steakhouse where if you want a steak, you pay for a steak. If you want the creamed spinach, you pay separately for the creamed spinach. God help you if you want a baked potato, and even God can't help you if you want butter and sour cream on it. I mean, everything has a price. Nothing is included. It is an entirely a la carte menu. And it is expensive. And they serve USDA prime beef and blah, and white tablecloths and white napkins and good heavy silverware and sautéed mushrooms. And you get to, and I mean, you can go in and do dinner for two and be out of there for $200, $300 if you order wine. So, Nashville is an upscale, trendy, an awfully fun place. But apparently, you don't want to be hosting your holiday fete at Morton's of Nashville. There were 16 people who went to Morton's for their holiday Christmas dinner. Must be a pretty well-to-do company that thinks pretty well of some portion of its employees. And you can't just go into Morton's in your jeans and your V-neck T-shirt and your flip-flops. Morton's is not a casual dining establishment. And apparently the other thing you cannot do at Morton's is wear your hat. That is what Robert Chambers found out the hard way. They'd gotten to the end of the $2,000 company Christmas dinner, the 16-member party had, 16-top in restaurant lingo, I think. And Robert Chambers, who has cancer, had gotten rather cold and decided to put on his hat. Upon putting on his hat while still in the dining area of Morton's of Nashville, the staff of said Morton's collectively lost their tiny, itsy-bitsy, little-bitty freaking minds. Including the manager. By the way, did I mention to you... maybe it wasn't Morton's. Maybe it was... No, Ruth's Chris is another steakhouse very similar to Morton's. They used to advertise on Flush Flemball's program. I don't know if they still do or not. That's not like I listen. But in fact, the manager came bustling up to Mr. Chambers and said, "Take off the hat. You want to wear that hat in here, you need a doctor's note, or you need to be seated away from other diners if you want to wear a hat in Morton's of Nashville." It was Mr. Chambers took umbrage. And so did Mr. Chambers' colleagues at the $2,000 company dinner. They all collectively took such umbrage that the management of Morton's of Nash Vegas felt it necessary to call the local constabulary, at which point Nashville's finest showed up and escorted all 16 people from the premises. And apparently Morton's is an upscale enough place that, well, perhaps they haven't been paying attention to this whole social media thing that's going on out there. But they learned in a drop-dead hurry. the people who were a part of, and this tells you that even among the aggrieved, there's a certain amount of privilege at work here. The people who were part of the company dinner ran over to a website called Yelp, Y-E-L-P, and this is where one posts reviews of restaurants. And they began hammering on the Morton's Corporation. At which point, Chief Operating Officer Tim Whitlock of Morton's began having kittens with crocheted tails. Because where before Morton's had consistently received a 5-star rating on Yelp, its average dropped to 1 star in the course of 30 days. There were postings on Yelp, there were postings on Facebook, and COO Tim Whitlock again looked around at the board and said, "We've got to protect our phony baloney jobs." Harumph. And suddenly they found Mr. Chambers' telephone number. And they issued the following statement on Facebook. Our executive team, notice it's a team, you know, just like the Yankees or the Indians or the Seahawks or the Cowboys or the Redskins or the Lakers. Or it's a team, damn it. Shouldn't it say the members of the body of our immortal corporation? Nah, it just doesn't come off so well. Our executive team has been in contact with Mr. Chambers, who fully accepted our apology. Now quit shitting on us on Yelp. Okay, he didn't say that part. They continued, there was a complete and total misunderstanding by our staff, who had no idea that our guest had a medical condition. Our actions were uninformed, and our intentions were not malicious. I always make it a point to call the police on someone when my intentions are not malicious. As a sign of our sincere apology and commitment to the community, we are donating on behalf of Mr. Chambers $2,000, because that's how much the company Christmas dinner cost. On behalf of Mr. Chambers, we are donating $2,000 to the St. Jude's Hospital. In addition, Morton's the Steakhouse will also partner with Mr. Chambers. See, they're partners now. Don't forget to wash up when you're done, Mr. Chambers. You can get icky things from partnerships like that. Morton's Steakhouse will also partner with Mr. Chambers to underwrite a concert fundraiser. You see, it was a misunderstanding. The team at Morton's of Nashville didn't understand that they were not supposed to defecate on a person for wearing a hat. Mr. Chambers noted that Mr. Whitlock was very apologetic. He said, end result, Morton's will make a donation in the amount of our check to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Apology accepted. Time to be on. I have more important things to fight than Morton's. He has cancer, remember? Thanks to all of you for your words of support and angst over the situation. I like to think that as long as I have the memory of this incident in my mind, or in my memory, I guess you couldn't say I have the memory of it, I didn't experience it, but as long as I continue to recall that this incident occurred, and not just with regard to the Mortons in Nashville, but the Mortons any damned where on this planet, you could not drag me in there with a 20 mule team. And the larger question becomes one of, how do you explain to an immortal corporation that they need just to quit? They need to go out of damn business. They need to just go out of business, liquidate, and let somebody else fill the vacuum who wants to not give hell to cancer patients for wearing a freaking hat. Hmm? Maybe that seems extreme. But how in the world else are we to exact something resembling, there's that word, that unintentional theme for the evening, justice from an outfit like this? I just keep a list. Nope, not going in there, not going in there, not going in there either. The kind of stuff that keeps you out of the clown, out of Wendy's, out of, you know, Taco Hell, and yeah, out of $200 dinner places like Morton's. Of course, I don't like to eat corporate anyway. When I occasionally, and I do mean occasionally, have to eat out, like DC and stuff, I bust my ass to stay out of chains. It's always good to put the money back into the community, because that whole economic multiplier effect. Or, you may feel differently. Maybe Morton's is your favorite place to, you know, drop a couple of Benjamins. But if you don't make an immortal corporation who has more rights than you do, if you don't make them understand the gravity of their screw-up, and if they are not punished, what is, because remember, this is the way the criminal justice system works. You got to punish those poors, or they won't understand that the wealth in this country will not tolerate their actions. Why does that not apply? I think it does. Food, as it were, for thought, I guess. So let's take a break, come back to your calls. Lines are open either on the traditional phone line, 304-658-3333, or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn, and either way works just dandy. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, December 17, 2013.
Temperatures have not risen in the past 12 years. They've gone down.
Wrong again, Tucker Carlson and Fox News. November 2013 was the hottest November on record.
15 homes have been destroyed near Big Sur, including the fire chief's own house.
Wacky winter wildfires strike tinder dry California. Better ski the Italian Alps before they melt. Plastic pollution now confirmed in all the Great Lakes. Plus,
but actually, plastics are several times more valuable than steel.
A new solution to the plastic pollution problem.
All of those solutions straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Rachel Maddow Show is brought to you by ExxonMobil.
And yeah, there's that. And that's why this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the Rachel Maddow program is sponsored by ExxonMobil. They have been playing those advertisements for the last week or two. Those are not the usual ads. That's a read-on. That is much more expensive than a regular ad. I wonder what ExxonMobil thinks they are buying from Rachel Maddow with those.
Yeah, that's got to cost a pretty penny.
And you got to wonder, does it make the Rachel Maddow show think twice before covering a story that would hurt ExxonMobil? In any case, very interesting. Now, today, as we go to air, it's the 50th anniversary of the Clean Air Act signed by President Johnson. As dirty as our air is now, you got to wonder how much dirtier it would have been had it not been for the government tyranny back in 1963 when Johnson signed that act.
Yeah, just ask anybody who lived in Los Angeles in the 1970s how much better things are now.
And they've been fighting it ever since. They're still fighting regulation of pollution in the air. That's what this is all about. Speaking of, what do you have for us today?
Well, first, some extremely wacky December weather. In California, it's the driest year on record this year, and although wildfire season is over, a rare December wildfire has destroyed at least 15 homes in Big Sur, including that of the fire chief. In Florida, a freaky tornado in December caused major damage to several homes in the city of Palm Coast. But the wacky weather winner is Cairo, Egypt, where it snowed over the weekend for the first time in 112 years. Nope, that's not unusual at all.
So wildfires in winter, tornadoes in December in Florida, and it's snowing in Cairo. I've seen people say that proves there's no global warming because it's snowing in Cairo. What part of extreme weather do you people not get about climate change?
Meanwhile, it's official. November 2013 was the hottest November ever recorded on the planet Earth. That's according to both NASA and NOAA.
Oh, there's that too.
This November beats previous winter November 2010 for the top spot, making November 2013 number one for hotness.
And then you have Fox News going on air and saying stuff like this.
There's, in fact, an emerging scientific consensus that we may be in for a period of global cooling.
Doesn't Tucker Carlson and Fox News ever get tired of being wrong?
Apparently not, because unless something really crazy happens, it looks like 2013 will rank as the fifth hottest year globally. The 10 hottest years on record have all occurred since 1998.
But it's not getting warmer, it's getting colder, we're entering a cold period, and these are not the droids you're looking for.
Hey, ski the Italian Alps while you still can, because they are warming twice as fast as the global average. That's according to a new study. Analysis of a nearly 3,000-year-old pine needle that was retrieved from a melting glacier in the Italian Alps confirms that areas of high elevation that had been frozen for millennia are now rapidly changing due to higher global temperatures. In the U.S., plastic pollution is now in the Great Lakes. New research confirms a toxic soup of microscopic plastic particles is now polluting all of the Great Lakes, so tiny that if you put one on a penny, it would be about the size of Abraham Lincoln's nose. Microscopic plastic particles absorb toxic chemicals like mercury and are mistaken for food by fish. And now researchers have confirmed that fish that eat contaminated plastic become contaminated themselves. They say more research is needed to see if those chemicals are being passed up the food chain. Finally, globally, less than 10% of all plastic is recycled. But there is a solution. Plasticbank.org pays people in poor countries to collect plastic for recycling. What they've done is they've developed a comprehensive new plastics recycling method that solves the problems of recycling plastic and drastically increases the value of recycled plastic as a raw material for manufacturers using less than 1% of the energy of virgin plastic.
For much more on that and the other stories we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. We'll be taking a break in a little bit for the holidays, and afterwards we will return at a new location on iTunes. So you free subscribers to the Green News Report on iTunes, stop by bradblog.com after the new year to find out where to go. Until then, find us and like us on the Facebook, follow us 24/7 on the Twitters, and feel free to throw a donation in our direction, at least until ExxonMobil decides to sponsor us too. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Where's the evening going? A note from Kate, who just helped us break the $100 barrier for this evening's fundraising. Only need 9 more folks at $10 a piece, and we'll get this evening taken care of and stay out of a hole. We're not in one now. We will be by the end of show, into the program, if we don't get something going here. But anyway, Kate says, FYI, hot sauce on a candy cane might be good. Crystal on ice cream works just fine. Vanilla or chocolate. Crystal hot sauce. Oh, yes, I know this. I know this. We've discussed it, in fact. That's why I thought, yeah, dousing the candy cane. No, it might actually be tasty. But then again, I'm a weirdo. I'll just about drink hot sauce straight out of the bottle, depending on the brand. I'm particularly fond of Cholula chili lime. But, yes, Crystal. And there's one more out there. I think it's made in Costa Rica. Coming to and from D.C., I can stop at this little international market in Manassas. And it's called Lisano, L-I-S-A-N-O. And I go absolutely wild for the stuff. And Ferg and I were talking about it the other day. And he said, you know, Dad, I'm almost betting this would be good on ice cream. I said, me too. But we haven't worked around to trying it yet. Kate notes also, reflecting on the program thus far, I ate crayons, pencil erasers, chewed the wood after the eraser was gone. Library paste was main fare, too. Yeah, I was stressed out by long division. Chewing on anything worked for me. Fortunately, no one made you eat a hot sauce-soaked crayon. God. Kate says, now on to another subject. Come on, folks. Throw in the $10 bill. It's painful to hear a whole program but go by with no contributions. If we're so devoted to our Horn family, put your money where your devotion is. Please. Just say it. Signed, Kate. She says it ever so much better than I do. But the fact of the matter is, it's like Brad Friedman said, there ain't no Exxon ad. There will never be any Exxon ads. And as I noted in the chat room a few minutes ago, anybody who thinks that Exxon-level advertising will not impose a little bit of self-censorship has never cashed a for-profit media paycheck. It's that simple. You're not sitting there saying, oh, no, they've bought my silence. But every time you cash that check, you think, you know, maybe there's a more important story we could cover. I mean, I remember getting called on the carpet back in America's fifth smallest radio market some many years ago now, because just one evening covering a story out of the state about how consumers, I hate that word, how people were being shat upon by the insurance industry, I said, listen, Snake Farm is not a good neighbor, and Allsnake is not on your side. The next day, I was on the carpet being told that advertising from State Farm and Allstate was very, very important to that station, and they would appreciate it if I would lay off the advertisers. I said I wasn't laying off. That was just an object. Well, don't do it. See how it works? To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Yeah, okay, well, I guess it's working. I swear, I kept calling before. It never worked.
Well, no, oh, I saw your message come through on Facebook, or on Twitter, and I was like, what the hell? No. No idea.
Oh, well.
But the magic is working.
Yeah, well, these cell phones are a bit hellish. I'm sure it'll be some sort of issue.
Well, we can always say
anyway,
hi to Agent Fred, and maybe he'll leave us alone.
All right. Well, I was wondering if you read that Bill McKibben article.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I guess he ain't sounding too, I don't know. I mean, he always is fairly optimistic type, but that article wasn't very hopeful, and he pointed out some pretty ugly realities about Obama's climate change policies. It's pretty bad.
I don't think it's even, and I'm not talking about being fair to Barack Obama. I don't think it's fair to refer to it as a climate change policy. It's not doing much.
Well, his energy policy.
Yeah,
man,
see.
How about that? Because
yeah.
I didn't even realize that one quote that he quoted when he was talking about, oh, we can circle the earth with all our, you know, oil production. I'm just like, you know, it's truly scary because the climate seems to be completely out of control. I saw that picture in Cairo, and I was just gobsmacked. That was incredible.
Yeah, that does not prove that there's no, you know, as Brad referenced, that doesn't prove that there's no global climate change. It proves that it's here with its pants on.
Yeah, no, I mean, that goes to from that scientist from Rutgers who specializes in mangled air jet streams and how they just sit in place and horrible weather ensues. They don't move; they just stay. And wherever they lodge, you get either extreme heat or extreme winter now. And all this is tracking back to the disappearing, Arctic. So, you know, I mean,
the feedback loop may be on now.
Well, you know, it's pretty bad. I mean, I think you have more blue water than you have white ice, so the albedo effect is dissipating, which is bad news for us, man. Very bad news.
Yeah, I mean, see, and the business with President Obama, that's why, I don't know if you caught it, but it was when I got back from Wisconsin, I had been alerted to this story that was absolutely not reported. It showed up on some tribal websites, but they host this gathering of tribal nations thing in D.C. every year now. And I happened to have a couple of friends who went to it, and we were just talking, and they were spitting nails, and I got directed to this article all about how Barack Obama opens his speech to the tribal leaders, and on the one hand he's sitting there, you know, we know you value the heritage of your land, blah 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 blah, you know, smoke up the ass, that stuff, and then turns around and says, that's why we've got to intelligently manage your energy resources. And he ain't talking about wind and solar, Sandra. It was full on drill, baby, drill.
Wow. So, what, he was just saying that we're going to be on these lands drilling away?
He was saying that he wants the tribal people who have sovereign control of their own land to start fracking and drilling for all they're freaking worth. And, of course, there are some tribes with some big-time lands that are out there in coal reserves, getting on a boat and going to China. And I know you've seen the Shanghai pictures.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the thing about what's going on in China is that, you know, the ruling Politburo, communists, whatever, they're all freaking out because people are starting to say, well, no, I can't set up shop there, you know, so it's working against them. Obviously, it's working against the poor Chinese, but it's working against their capitalist aspirations because, oopsie, you can't be the world's workshop without poisoning your environment totally and completely. I guess they missed that memo.
And even if they've got some sort of people's common turn Politburo of Malthusian approaches to Chinese economy, there's once that stuff gets started, it's not like, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are some people in the lead saying, yeah, you know, if we lost a half a billion here, it wouldn't be so bad. I mean, that's really, really brutal and cynical, but, you know, but the thing is, once it gets rolling, you can't say, okay, we've killed off enough of our people, we're going to stop now. They've got something going there that they can't control, Sandra.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's the same thing with what he wrote in that article about, well, you know, our coal use may be going down, but we're exporting, and the atmosphere don't have no borders. So, I mean, it's pretty, you know, that's pretty easy for any idiot to understand, and yet we have a president that's just sort of, you know, banging your drums about, oh, you know, energy independence, and it's just like, dude, why don't you take a look at your daughters, you know, or something, you know, because it's really out of control, what he's proposing, and to me, it's just making Obama look more and more just like an advertisement, you know, something out of the Manchurian Candidate, because doesn't seem to be too much there, because you don't have to be some sort of radical environmentalist to see what is happening, and, you know, with the sort of destruction of capitalism all at once, I mean, it's just, you know, we're definitely entering a whole new era. I am sort of, it's kind of shocking when the global politics is so far right that you're calling the Catholic Pope a fucking Marxist. I mean, that's a joke. He ain't no Marxist. It's just that things are so whacked out of this world that what he's sounding like, you know, it's just a, you know, a human response. And it's just kind of like, and they're mad because dude is articulate too with the comebacks. He's like, oh no, MFers, when the glass is full, it ain't trickling down. It's just getting bigger and flowing over. I just thought that whole image was so fantastic. You know, I thought, wow, that really does lay they shit way out to the point where they had to roll out that fat fuck Rush Limbaugh to say something, and the Pope came back on his ass. And I'm like, ooh. You know, it's nice having somebody that's not European up in that mug.
Yeah, but it would also, I mean, I'll take all the help I can get, Sandra. But
he needs to give away all the money, then I'll be a real believer, but, you know.
But what's his latest? He's chucking out the, who's that bishop from St. Louis that didn't want people taking communion? Yeah, he's gone.
He's gone. I mean, that's an interesting move right there. No, I took note of that, and I will continue to follow because it's not like he don't have the truth on his side about this economic system. You know, globalization of indifference. I mean, that is the statement of the fucking year, and that's from that Pope. And I'll give him some props for that. The other thing I wanted to mention is the disgusting a story that slipped out about Obama and his $500 million for his presidential library. And this one guy that I followed said, these are starting to feel like communist mausoleums with a subprime public to match. Because come on. How many years does he have left? Three? And they're already laying out. You know, it's disturbing.
Well, you have to start early on your library. I mean, Bush isn't even fully open yet, is it?
I think it is, but I mean, it's just kind of presiding over the fall, or, you know, it's like the last days of some kind of empire here where you have these idiots like Obama even leaking shit like this. It's disgusting.
Well, I guess based on, you know, who you were talking about previously, is there any chance anywhere in the next 20 years of a president coming onto the scene who will kind of have, and I feel funny about this, referring to the Pope as a moral force. I mean, but this guy is trying to be a moral force.
Rough,
you know,
that one.
He's still completely screwed in the head as far as women are concerned and birth control and things like that. But at least on the social justice front, he gets it. What are the odds of someone entering the White House in the next 20 years who gets it like that?
Well, I mean, I see things, you know, because the only thing that looks interesting, and it's kind of backdoorish, but this decision that's going to come down from the Ninth Circuit in D.C. that may throw net neutrality overboard could really be a huge mistake on the corporate state's part, because everybody is all about, especially the younger people who would make things real shitty for them, they're all about their internet. And if this decision goes through and net neutrality, no matter if people don't understand what it means is that the internet is going to get fucked. And that might be a huge problem for them.
Well, is this a modification of what I've been saying for years about there won't be, nobody's going to be in the streets until the cable goes out? If this thing goes through, the under 30 crowd is going to hit the streets?
Well, what's going to happen is you're going to see these rapacious, pernicious corporations start going soprano on us. It ain't going to be pretty. And they may try to do it slowly, like a boiled frog type thing, but trust me, they're going to get greedy and start gatekeeping big time, slowing shit down, just making the internet a nightmare. And I think that the Finns didn't make broadband a human right for nothing. I think it's a problem. So keep that in mind. I think that it's something that to keep checking, because that's a big mistake. Okay, they may want to control it and try to extract more rent, but at some point you just push it too far. And I think when you have college people coming out of college in $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, $200,000 in debt, moving back to their parents, never being able to get married, have a home, you are brooding a big problem. You're breeding a big problem.
Well, see, I was having that conversation yesterday, Sandra, with a very old friend of mine, and he said I have no idea, because he's got a couple of kids. They're like 9 and 10. Mine are upper ends of teens, and I'm scared out of my mind. And at 9 and 10, he's scared to death for his, because he's done everything right. He's saved and he's worked like a draft animal. And but he said, you know, I'm not going to be, by the time they're 18, I'm not going to be able to just pay cash for college. And that means they're going to be saddled up with a bunch of debt. And he said, I have no idea where they're going to get a job, because there aren't any.
No, but I mean, and also, you know, I just think that this sort of economic paradigm we have, with the sort of tapering that they keep talking about and people freaking out about, the global economy is in a real shit when markets are freaking out because of just the mere thought of the U.S. Fed pulling back on their money printing or whatever the hell they're doing. I just think, the next crash that comes around, you know, all them young people, people don't keep paying them student loans. That's a huge bubble, over a trillion.
So kids start defaulting. Young people start defaulting on student loans.
Right. It's a huge bubble.
And
okay? It's a massive bubble.
And what's more, their credit gets ruined.
Well,
so they can't participate in the debt structure of the economy as they grow into full, family era maturity.
Well, they can't do that anyway when they're paying 40%, 30% of their whatever meager income they have now. You see what I'm saying? So if they go default, their credit gets ruined. But if they keep paying it, they're never going to be able to acquire anything, because the jobs aren't paying enough to justify the debt. I mean, the debt is not dischargeable,
and yet,
which is evil.
Yeah, the you can't discharge it in bankruptcy under any circumstance. Hell, you can't discharge student loan debt by dying.
No, but that's a decision. That is not like something that's some law of nature.
No.
You see what I'm saying? That's a decision that's made, and if I'm, you know, please, someone in the Horn family, tell me I'm wrong, but didn't Senator Obama vote for that law?
That would be yes.
Okay, well, you know, this is why I was lukewarm on that M.O., mofo, when I first heard about him. But anyway, so this is a decision to put our young people in some sort of indentured servitude, probably because they think that's a way of mollifying them. But with a bubble like that and people wanting to eat and whatnot, that'll be the first thing not to be paid. Trust me. I ain't away.
And then?
Well, and then I don't know what they're going
to
do. So
bubble bust, right? I mean,
prison?
Well, debtor's prison does seem to...
Know.
Well, at least somebody get, you know, if people remember, we've got an expansion of the debtor's prison complex. There's a new study out about Colorado putting people in debtor's prison.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is sort of gearing up, and that system is well entrenched in this country. So there's all sorts of holes ready made, but I just think the sheer number of people who are going to be not paying if and when we have another sort of crash, it's just going to be overwhelming. And, it, you know, it's just going to add to the calamity. It's probably going to cause huge unemployment to spike.
Yeah, I mean, you know I can't resist the political speculation, Sandra. But honest to God, you know, there... Bernie Sanders has made some rumblings that if somebody progressive doesn't step up, he'll run for president in 2016.
Right.
People are lining up begging Elizabeth Warren to run. It'll be the usual cast of weirdos, misogynists, and freaks on the Republican side. And I don't... I hate saying this. I wish there was enough force and momentum to bring somebody like Bernie Sanders into the White House. Do you see it?
Well, no, but what I do see is you would never, you know, I mean, it is so true about politics in America and how what's coming from below really does sort of make a difference, because that motherfucker wouldn't be talking about inequality if it wasn't for these damn wildcat fast food strike. That shit is for real.
Yes, it is.
And it's interesting, and it's what is going to make any kind of movement happen. If you lock those people up with students and indentured servitude, the debt peonage, you know, this is what is on the horizon. And Hillary Clinton, booyah on that bitch. She going over and telling all the bankers, "Don't worry, we won't be hassling you anymore." You heard about that little?
Yeah, oh yeah, that was.
Well, she's tripping. I mean, I think there's a lot of hatred just bubbling over for the political and the rich. You know.
Yeah, but what happens, Sandra, you know, because of the nefarious nature of our politics, I mean, I can almost hear it and see it and smell it and taste it already from here. You know, we will be presented with some dichotomy between former Secretary Clinton and some freak from the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, even if she does get in, that's not the thing. I mean, I just think that the politics is going pear-shaped when you have this sort of, what was I reading today? You know, that the 1% or whatever you want to call them, they're hogging up so much of the income, you know, that it's just squeezing and slowing the economy, and people aren't being paid enough to survive anymore. This is, you know, this is going to be a problem. I don't know if it's going to result in some sort of new union-type movement, but it's happened before in this country, and it's always due to people being pushed over the edge and the rich being oblivious. I don't know if you've seen that. I tweeted that Christmas card that Jamie Dimon sent out.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
I mean, you have that, and you also have this business in Texas where this motherfucker can roll, kill four people and maim a whole bunch of people and have a defense of he's so rich that he don't know right and wrong? Oh, no. The communities are freaking out about this. The rich are really sort of, you know, they're starting to get to that 1788 mode, that feeling.
It feels that way, and that's you were talking about the fast food strike, Sandra, and that's something I wanted to bring up. One of the things that's kind of telling out of that is where the fast food strikes are going on. They're happening in cities where living conditions are particularly brutal. I find it kind of weird geographically when you bump it up against a place like where I live that's almost a cradle of labor activism. Well, there is not a sign to be found. I mean, even in a university city like Morgantown or Huntington, there's not a sign to be found outside of a McDonald's or a Burger Thing or a Wendy's or any of that. Because people are scared to death. They cannot even lose that.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, listen, this isn't any sort of thing that's overnight. But you've had a lot of sort of interesting changes in during the Obama presidency that definitely will carry over to the post-Obama era. I'm not like predicting that it's going to be, you know, something amazing and wonderful. I fear the right-wing populism nabbing most of it because the Democrats are so useless. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's the second political question, Sandra. Okay, so we got no help coming in the White House. Where's the cavalry riding to the rescue in the Congress?
Well, no, I have to ask you, and I've asked other people, and no one can give me a reasonable answer. But what in the world? We're looking at 3.8 million people just being tossed into poverty because they're going to lose the unemployment extension. 3.8 million. Wow. What the hell? What are those people going to do?
Yeah, you mean, 3.8 million just getting told, getting the Cheney treatment. You know, go F yourself.
Right. And I'm just, you know, that's a lot of people. It's pretty much all at once, too. You know, it's not just a trickle. 100,000 here, 100, you know, it's like 1.8 at the end of the year, and then another 2 point something in the end of the first quarter. So, you know, I think that is, and to me, it makes me feel ashamed to even have voted for Democrats. Just that in itself, it's shameful.
Yeah, and that's
I take my head and I think, wow, this is.
But that's why it feels so often, Sandra, like some sort of an end game that nobody will admit is an end game. I mean, it's one thing. Well, you know, there's a story out there today about South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley having been found to have violated the civil rights of Occupy protesters in South Carolina. Big surprise. But, you know, at least Occupy was talking about these political failures. But I don't.
No, but you know.
I mean, just a
social movements are like that, though. To me, I don't. I mean, the Occupy stuff was smashed because they obviously identify the right thing.
Right, and therefore had to be made to go away. I mean, you know, I'd like, for instance, to have gotten really, really excited about Judge Leon's preliminary injunction ruling. But the fact is, you know, where the NSA is concerned, but that's a preliminary injunction. And he will be smacked down a rat hole.
Yeah, they'll find some way of, because the right hand of the state is dominant, and it's dominant for a reason. because they've decided that this form of casino capitalism and whatever government we have must be maintained, which isn't a democracy anymore, so you're going to have to suppress people.
That's a little bit that's more than a little bit frightening. So who gets, you know, who's going to get the treatment?
Well, you have, you know, more and more, it's interesting because I heard this interview, I forget the woman's name, you know, I need to get my facts and names, but I don't have it, so too bad. This woman wrote a book. It's some right-wing, you know, ideologue respected in their scene, slamming poor white people now. So they're not trying to recruit them anymore. They're starting to turn on them. I'll look the book up and send you a review of it. But yeah, they, you know, they're like talking about the very group that they were able to sort of get to vote for them. So I think there's a understanding in elite circles that, you know, the middle class here is not going to remain the same, and so we're going to have to start demonizing everybody who's poor, you know. So
yeah, that's well. Randy just sent in a comment from PA, and he said it is becoming cheaper to suppress the population than it is to correct problems. And again, that's terrifying to behold, because again, that's one of those big goose steps into fascism.
Well, also when you can turn the suffering and the prison, when you can turn holding black and brown bodies and now add poor white bodies and turn a profit on them, you're gonna round them up. And I don't mean that in like FEMA camp, so don't start sending emails.
No.
I just mean, you know, when you make that first mistake, you're gone. You know how it is in society. If you're rich, you can run over people and get sent to some place. But if you're poor and you do one thing, I mean, you can rip off a $150 coat and, you know, you're gone for your natural life. So I just see things getting more and more punitive, where if you don't have everything in order, you can just be snatched and put in some profit center, privately owned hellhole.
That is, of course, subsidized by we the people, right? That's really the key.
Yeah, but, you know, through the various whatever. Anyway, that second Hunger Games movie is pretty fucking radical. So I'm surprised that got out there.
You've seen it?
I suggest you check it out. Anyway, I'll just leave it there because, you know, I don't want to get snatched right yet. I got a couple more things to do.
Gosh. how is the rest of Sandra's world?
You know, Sandra's world, if I can go football player on it, is, you know, kind of minimalist. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It's you know, it's on the DL, and yeah, I just sort of, I don't know, Bob. I'm just finding things to be a bit special.
No, there's an element of, and you know, you don't have to be a big Glenn Beck fan to do this. There's an element of lay in a week's supply of water and 2 weeks supply of beans and rice about all of this.
I like beans and rice, so that's a good deal.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you know, I'm kind of being somewhat facetious, but I just don't really like, I'm concerned, you know, because I have the cuties in my life. I just, you know, I am quite terrified of that because they have like, well, 9 years, they'll be 20 years old. What's going to be happening here in 9 years? Seriously, think about it.
I sympathize and empathize with that on all fronts, Sandra, because mine are 19, going to be 18 in a week, and on the way to 17. And those are the three who don't already have children. And I'm clueless. I mean, I am, how do I put this, Sandra? I'm operating in a world
that is absolutely not remotely comparable to the world I was living in at the same age when my parents were saying, well, you know, let's get busy applying to colleges and we'll fill out the family financial statement. And I'm not being facetious about my parents. My dad busted his ass and so did my mother. But this is not that. And where I live, what do you say, and I'm not being sexist about this, what do you say to a soon-to-be 18-year-old male in a world where all the jobs are either the coal mines, the military, or fast food? What do you say to that kid? I mean, and that's not a rhetorical question. I'm looking for help here.
No, I mean, you know, it's funny that I guess that Matt Taibbi, I found that article to be completely smug and kind of disgusting. But it's funny that, you know, you're starting to get articles about the wasteland that is like Detroit and Camden and on and on and on, what Chris Hedges was talking about a couple of years ago. They had done that book.
Yeah.
But it's getting to the point where, you know, you already have pockets of kind of America dystopia, you know, where those places will never get help. They've just been sacrificed, and that's just it. But the Camden is just outrageous what's going on. It's like a sort of marketplace of drug slinging, and that's about it.
And I mean, you know me and my long view of history. I just keep thinking about those pyramids in the Central American jungle. One day everybody just walked away. But the people didn't die out. They just gave up on that particular paradigm. Isn't that what we're seeing?
The U.S. definitely has that air about it. The whole thing is such a sort of experiment. And, you know, experiments come to an end. You know, it's not like there's something dynastic here. It isn't. It definitely has that feel that it could be balkanized, and you'll have some places that are livable and other places that aren't. You know, just that kind of stuff. So,
well, that's like by way of a suggestion, Randy just wrote back in and said, the first thing you do is get your kids' passports.
Well, yeah, that is, you know what, that's always the case.
But is there somewhere else on the planet that this stuff can't reach?
No, I mean, I just think, you know, either we're going to have to come together as a, you know, global community, and I know that's an anathema in this country, or it's just not going to work out for this species, and that the world will go on. This is the thing. I mean, Americans and humans in general are just smug, but they need to understand that this rock will keep on spinning.
Damn. It's...
No, but anyway...
Well... I don't know if sobering is the right word to use, but it is.
Yeah, no, it's not very nice, and I don't really have anything. Well, except, I haven't even really been paying that much attention to the football this season.
No, me neither.
I mean, I was looking at it for a bit, but it's all hit and miss, and I don't know. I just was, you know, I'm trying to think, is there one game coming up that I know?
No. I mean,
it's more just derision, you know, because I was laughing. It's not sad, but I was laughing at the Giants, at Eli Manning. I'm like, sit down.
Now I'll get hate mail from the Giants fans. No, I mean, for me, the only thing between now and then that I'm worked up about is Auburn versus Florida State. And even that is just a nasty mess with, you know, all the rape allegations and, you know, kid got a walk from the county DA. You got to wonder, if he wasn't playing in the national championship and a Heisman contender. Okay, let's put it a different way. Let's say this kid's never picked up a football in his life and he just happens to live on the wrong end of Tallahassee. You think he gets a walk, or do you think he gets, let's put it to the jury treatment?
Who knows? I mean, depends on the color of the victim. To me, I'm sorry, but you know,
yeah.
God knows. I mean, all that is just.
And yet, even with that, the national championship game is going to be between Florida State and Auburn, which means that I'm either going to have to heavily medicate myself,
or put in the little sound suppressors that keep me from being able to hear, because, you know, Brent Musburger naked under a raincoat is going to be behind the microphone of that game, Sandra. You remember last year?
You know what? Isn't it time for glory? I mean, how old?
Yeah, that's tonight's glory call.
Oh, my God. No, for real, he's just terrible. And also, the other fun thing in sports, and which is also, is still negative, what can I say, was the sort of category that the U.S. soccer team found themselves in for the World Cup. They ain't going to last a game.
No, that's the you're going nowhere ticket.
You ain't going nowhere. I was like, damn, that was a nasty lineup for them. See, so I was giddy about that. I'm thinking, damn, I need, you know, some valerian or something. Shit.
Yeah. By the way, Isaac just let us know that the victim in that particular rape case that's not being prosecuted had, in Isaac's words, DNA all over her.
You know what? That's right up there with Santa Claus. We need to really, I just don't know what to say about that. Thanks, Isaac.
Yeah, owe you big time for that. Gonna go shower with bleach now.
Yuck. Oh, my God.
And we didn't get around to Santa Claus.
Oh, listen, you know what, that's another thing that I am, you know, really, I just don't understand. I saw that clip of that really horrible white woman. What's her name?
Megyn Kelly. I think we can just stop with horrible white woman, Sandra.
Well, as if kids watch that. That's what I was sitting there thinking. I'm like, no child that I know or want to know or care about is going to lay there, clap their eyes on your dumb ass.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
No, and that's why then, you know, to have John Stewart turn around and turn it into an everybody in West Virginia is a racist joke was a little bit of a pisser.
Yeah, see, I missed all that, but I was sort of, you know, I just thought how she said Jesus and Santa Claus. And that's why I had to retweet Stephen Walt saying, you know, what in the fuck, he didn't say that, but I'm just sort of paraphrasing, what in the fuck kind of empire is arguing about Santa Claus?
The ethnicity of a right, exactly. And that's why I started that hashtag about other historic white people. I got to tell you, I was particularly proud of Mandingo, Shaka Zulu, Bob Barr, hashtag other historic white people. But
oh, know. My God.
and I was sending them all straight to her, so.
And in more sort of horrible cult news, they had that sexual harasser Bob Barker. He's still alive. He's like 90. And they had him on The Price is Right doing some call. I'm like, what?
Oh, and he's gotten into politics. He's endorsed some right-wing POS down in Florida.
Oh, God, I could have done without that. I'm thinking, come on, you know, once again. It's just glory call all around. Isaac tweeted me that Billy Graham was almost dead. He ain't gone yet, is he?
Nope.
When's
nope.
Gonna end?
Evil is a preservative, Sandra. Well, I hope it's not such a long interval between us talking again next time. It's been way too long.
Hopefully not. But anyway, your show is over with, so listen, have a good one.
All right, we'll see you, Sandra. Bye now.
Bye.
It has been way too long since talking to Sandra. So we may have been cut off a little bit, but it'll show up on the archive. So you guys have a wonderful evening, and we'll talk tomorrow. Hey, it's prayer meeting Wednesday. And I'm proud to say we came up only $90 short for this evening's fundraising. So we'll shoot for $240 tomorrow evening. Y'all take care.